Hey, it's Cognosis, and I'm excited to be talking to Dr. Kyle Smith about his book, Call to the Dead. Hi, Dr. Smith. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, John. How are you?
Good, good, good. So, what inspired you to write Call to the Dead? And I guess this is a multi-part question, so there's part A. But I was wondering if you can explain the title, because many non-scholars may see that and think, you know, oh, okay, like, is he saying Christianity is a death cult, like Heaven's Gate or something? Is this one of those new atheist books? What's up with this? So could you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so let me give some background, and then I'll explain the title a bit, right? I mean, I've been studying texts about early Christian martyrs for years. I mean, mainly the long sort of narrative stories that are told about them, but also the encomia, or the speeches of praise that are written about the martyrs, about the homilies that are preached in their honor on their feast days, which is to say, you know, the date on the calendar when they are believed to have died. And I've written a number of books, including translations of some of these texts, specifically in Syriac, which is a dialect of Aramaic that became the preeminent Christian literary language throughout large parts of the Eastern Mediterranean and Northern Mesopotamia. But what I wanted to do with this book was, first of all, go beyond just the literary stories about the early Christian saints to include all of the ritual and cultural practices by which the martyrs were remembered for centuries, many centuries. So in other words, to put the martyrs at the center of the story of Christianity, and to tell a brief history, as the subtitle is, says, you know, which is a bit of a bait and switch because we don't really quite get up to the 21st century, but at least beyond the Protestant Reformation. To tell that story over the centuries with the martyrs at the center. And secondly, to do so in a way that I hope is entertaining for a non-specialist audience, right? And this is the first sort of non-academic book that I've written, or specifically scholarly book. And so about the title, though, what does that mean, Cult of the Dead? I'm not being dismissive here of Christianity or suggesting that it's like Heaven's Gate, as you said, or, you know, some other sort of cult. And I understand that when we hear that word cult, or you say, you know, oh, his sister ran off and joined a cult, this is not a good thing, right? You think of, you know, dark back alleys and candlelit stuff and who knows whatever else. But that is not the way in which scholars of early Christianity used the term. To refer to the cult of the saints is a very common phrase by way of referring to the ways in which Christians have cared for their saints. I mean, that really is what the word means. Like, think of the word agriculture. It literally means to care for the fields, right? Or to cultivate a plant, or a child's love of music is to nurture it, right? To care for it. So when you're talking about the cult of the dead or the cult of the saints in Christianity, it's all of these practices that go well beyond just the stories about the martyrs, to talk about how the martyrs remained very much alive through their continued presence in the ritual life of the church via the days that they're remembered on the calendar, these homilies that I mentioned that are being preached in their honor, the shrines, the churches that are dedicated to them, even the veneration of their physical remains, their relics, and the many miracles that were attributed to the intercession of the relics, or in the intercession of the saints. So that's the book, right? To explain, again, in what I hope is an entertaining way that traverses a lot of geography, a lot of chronology, how the culture of Christianity, for most of its history, is really best understood as a cult of the saints.
Yeah, yeah. And could you, for those unfamiliar, can you explain what a cultural history is?
Yeah, sure. This is a complicated sort of subgenre of history writing, but in just to distill it to one quick sentence, it's a means of writing history that focuses specifically on the arts and the culture of a particular people in a particular place. So again, all of these rituals by which Christians have remembered their dead. So that's the historical focus.
Yeah. And so recent scholarship, it's tended to downplay the amount of early Christian martyrs as opposed to what we find in religious histories, or I'd even say the public imagination, right? If you're talking to somebody off the street, I don't know why you'd be talking to somebody off the street about this, but, you know, there's a common conception that Christians were thrown to the lions by the hundreds, right? That there was mass slaughter of the Christians. Recent scholarship has really interrogated this, found out that a lot of this was legendary. Were there early martyrs then, and why were they martyred?
Several questions there, right? I might rephrase it just a bit. Were there Christians who, for whatever reason, were killed by the authorities in late antiquity? Yes, undoubtedly. Were some of them remembered as martyrs, as witnesses to the faith for having given their lives rather than deny Christ? Yeah, also, yes, that I think is undoubtedly the case. But were, to the first part of your point, were thousands of Christians being killed for their faith in antiquity? There's just not the evidence to bear this out. And I think that, I'm certainly not the first to say that. As you say, it's become quite a point of scholarly investigation over the past however many decades. But I'm very fond of pithy quotations that, you know, distill things down to their essence, to their most sort of intelligible essence. And I think Paula Fredrickson put it best when she said, look, there weren't thousands of Christians being killed in antiquity, but there were thousands of people who were enamored by reading, reciting, repeating, remembering the stories of those few who were, right? So just as you said, right, you have this sort of popular imagination that's completely understandable, right? Even to the person on the street that you mentioned, though there must have been thousands of Christians being killed because we hear so much about the martyrs, right? You talk about walking down the street. We'll walk around on any city in whether in Europe or North America, South America, other places, and you're constantly running into St. George Street, San Andrew subway stop, St. Sebastian School, and so on. We're constantly surrounded by the martyrs, even if we don't have any idea who George or Andrew or Sebastian was. We see these saints' names all over the place, okay? So I think that when the story gets told again and again and again, it sticks, and it assumes an importance that is perhaps goes beyond its impact in the particular period or the event of a particular period that it is describing. Okay, I think what's important to understand is that especially when the stories are being told annually, when there are churches that are dedicated to all of these martyrs, when there are pilgrimages that are specifically devoted to going to a shrine of this or that martyr, when, just as I said, you know, even today, we've got all these streets and schools and subway stops that are still named for the saints, they assume an importance that looms very, very large. But I want to go back to one of the other questions that you said in terms of, you know, why were the early Christians killed? Why were some killed? I think that's an important question to answer. And it's not an easy question to answer because you have to focus on particular time periods in particular places. So it wasn't always just a one-size-fits-all answer. So, for example, a lot of those martyrs whose stories are told in Syriac that I mentioned, that I have worked on quite a lot, who are being killed, according to these stories, in the Persian Empire, outside of the Roman Empire, so in what's nowadays Iraq, basically, so northern Mesopotamia, northern and central Mesopotamia. According to some of those stories, the Christians were killed because the patriarch of the Christians, this guy by the name of Simeon Barsabai, Simeon the son of cloth dyers, refused to collect extra taxes that the king of Persia supposedly imposed upon all the Christians of his realm. Do we have any evidence for this? No. Why is this story being told? It's complicated, but you know, that text and then those who receive that text in the Roman Empire talk about the Persians killing tens upon tens of thousands of Christians. Again, the evidence just doesn't bear that out. But, you know, that So maybe taxes has one reason to do with it. That's in Persia. I think in the Roman Empire, one of the most intriguing episodes of Christian persecution didn't start out that way as intentionally being focused on Christians. And the episode that I'm referring to is a decree that was issued by the Roman Emperor Decius in the middle of the 3rd century. So Decius had a very short reign. He, after defeating the reigning Emperor Philip, and by the summer of 249, he becomes emperor. By the summer of 251, he's dead. Very short reign, right? But he came to power during a tumultuous time. It was a bad situation. You've got Germanic tribes invading. You've got the Persians pressing in from the east. You've got a constant assassination of one emperor after the next. You've got rebellions. You've got a devaluation of the coinage. You've got other economic problems that are going on in the middle of the 3rd century in the Roman Empire. So how do you turn this around? Well, it seems that Decius had this idea that that everyone in the empire wasn't doing what they should have been doing to honor the gods. How does the empire survive? How does the empire flourish again? Well, through the favor of the gods. So what does he say? He issues this decree saying that you have to have an official receipt for having made sacrifice. Often this was an animal sacrifice of some sort, though it could have been another sort of sacrifice, pouring out of wine or an offering of incense or something like that. And this it barely caused a blip in terms of the Roman history of the period. It's unremembered, but it caused quite a stir among Christians, right, who took it as a specifically an affront against them, because it was known by this time that Christians weren't going to be offering bits of incense to the Roman emperor as a god or to the other sorts of gods. You know, so Christians get maligned as being atheists, which, you know, sounds very perplexing to us to say, how would Christians be atheists? Well, if they're not honoring the gods of Rome and they're not doing their duty to help support the Roman state such that those same gods will help Rome, then they're atheists. They're also bad citizens, right? So, you know, now this kind of becomes this civic obligation. It was not only that, but it was a marker of your self-identification with the Roman Empire if you went along with this requirement to sacrifice. But I think the important point here, just to come back to this why question, is that it wasn't directed at Christians. That decree was empire-wide, and we have receipts that were found in the Egyptian desert, you know, that say something to the effect of, a priestess of the goddess Sukkos or such and such have duly sacrificed, right? This is not a Christian. This is being directed elsewhere, but Christians took it and understood it as an attack on them. And some of those who refused to sacrifice and very publicly refused to do so and may have ended up in a bad situation as a result, you know, the stories that are told about them are the ones that get remembered for this episode.
Right. And maybe an obvious question, maybe not, but why did early Christians revere martyrs?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can answer that question by looking at Jesus, right? Yes, unlike the martyrs, he's understood as the Messiah, as the divine Son of God, you know, sent to wash away the sins of the world, redeem humanity through his sacrificial death, however you want to phrase it. But a testimony to the truth of his message is that this willing acceptance of death, at least as it's narrated in Luke's gospel about Jesus, right? So you've got the cross. You've got the means by which Jesus was killed. It's an instantly recognizable symbol of Christianity and has been so for many, many centuries. But part of what I want to do with this book and what I wanted to show to general readers is that what's often forgotten about the cross is how early Christians held it up as a model for imitation again and again and again. It wasn't just like living like Jesus lived is the model to follow here, but being willing to die for him if or at least die rather than renounce his name or renounce their faith if it happened to come to that. And the roots of that are right in the New Testament itself, right? I mean, think about how the Gospels quote Jesus as warning his disciples that they're going to be, you know, flogged and dragged before kings and governors all for the sake of his name. Or think about how the Acts of the Apostles narrates the death of Stephen, the deacon Stephen, who's traditionally celebrated as the first Christian martyr. Right? He gets interrogated by the high priest in Jerusalem. He gives this long speech invoking the patriarchs of the Hebrew Bible, all by way of saying, prophets are always persecuted. Now you've just betrayed and murdered Jesus, the righteous one, as Stephen calls him, right? And then as he's being stoned to death, we get this absolutely fascinating parallel in the book of Acts between Jesus's death as it's narrated in Luke and that of Stephen as it's narrated in Acts. So Stephen repeats Jesus's final words from the cross, but instead of saying, as Jesus does, Father, receive my spirit, Stephen says, Lord Jesus, receive my spirit, right? This is why he's called the first Christian martyr, because in more or less his own words, he says, here he is, he's dying for Christ. And I mean, and to give it one more example from the many hundreds that I could choose from outside of the Bible, we hear from Ignatius, who's the bishop of Antioch in the early second century. He writes a letter to those who might enter. He writes a series of letters as he's being dragged from Antioch to Rome to be thrown to the lions, as you mentioned before. And he writes a number of letters, one of which specifically says to the people who might intervene on his behalf and save him from being killed, he says, no, 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 you're not doing me any favors by saving me and not letting me be killed. He says, I want to be ground up in the lion's jaws. He says, this is just what it means to be a disciple of Christ, okay? So, I mean, once you start going down this path and you're reading not just about the apostles, you know, for whom there, almost all of them, there is some tradition or another, in many cases, multiple traditions about how they met some sort of grisly end, all of Jesus's closest followers, but also Stephen, Ignatius, and just scores of others, it becomes a little unsettling, right? I mean, this is not, you know, some sort of prosperity gospel or some sort of, you know, Jesus wants to make you healthy and wealthy and wise, right? I mean, the thread of much of this literature from the early church is just what Ignatius says, that being willing to die for Christ isn't some sort of lofty ideal, but just what it means to be a true disciple.
Yeah. What's special about the relationship between Christians and the dead that, you know, wasn't found in other religions or in contemporary movements at the time? And of course, again, you know, I say contemporary movements, we're talking about, you know, the late antique period. We're talking about some different cultures and different times, but generally.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would say that that many cultures and religions, I mean, actually almost all, I would gather, have a great amount of respect for the dead. You know, many religious practices might change, but the ones that tend to be most resistant to change are funeral and burial practices. Those are the ones that take a long time to make any sort of change, because that's not what you want to touch, right? You want to bury your dead in the same way that, you know, you bury your parents in the same way that your parents buried their parents and their parents buried their parents, right? And you maintain a unity there. So, you know, that's on the one hand, but I would say that Christian notions of, I would say that Christians don't necessarily respect their dead any more than other cultures or other religions, or that there's necessarily a special relationship. However, the special relationship might come from the fact that the preeminent figure of Christianity, Jesus, obviously, died very violently and was then bodily assumed into heaven. So you have a new understanding of the body, of death and rebirth and resurrection that doesn't play out in the same way in other religions, right? This is a novel contribution here. But Christian notions of martyrdom, they didn't just emerge from the ether, right? Like most things, they were a product of their cultural context. So I think while it might be difficult to argue that martyrdom, as we understand it now retrospectively in the Christian sense, while it might be difficult to argue that that was also idealized in other cultures, I'm not quite sure that it was. I do think that we have we have functional martyrs, so to speak, in plenty of other ancient cultures. I mean, if you can just think about, you could easily make the argument that Socrates, for example, is a martyr, right? Even though he was never referred to as such, because he willingly accepted a death sentence rather than stop philosophizing. Or a more biblically relatable or intelligible parallel might be the story of the mother, a Jewish woman in Second Maccabees, one of the deuterocanonical books, who watches her seven sons, one after the next, die horrible deaths. You know, they get their tongue cut out, their tongues cut out, their heads scalped, their hands and feet cut off, you know, their bodies fried in a cauldron. It's awful. All because they refused to violate the law as it was given to Moses and eat pork, right? So they're not dying for Christ, but they seem to be dying for the law. And very intriguingly, those Maccabees, those Maccabean boys were kind of claimed after the fact by Christians as, you know, Christian martyrs, even though, you know, they're dying not for Jesus, and certainly even before Jesus existed, right? But they saw, early Christians definitely saw a parallel there in this willful, this willing acceptance of pain and torture and death, rather than renounce the law of your God, or in the case of the Christians, renounce their God. So I think that Christian notions of martyrdom are unique in many ways, but they borrow from the cultural context of from which they arose in late antiquity, and are maybe different in kind, so to speak, from many other religions. But you know.
Yeah. Can you tell us a bit about, you know, what role martyrs play in important early Christian texts? And then, you know, in texts throughout Christian history, you know, as much as you can talk about the last 2,000 years?
Sure. Well, maybe I'll just I'll focus on a couple here. Certainly they play a very large role. The martyrs do in early Christian texts, especially beginning around the fourth century and onward, when we really begin to get quite a number of these texts being written. Some perhaps earlier in the third century, for sure, but mostly in the fourth century when the cult of the saints takes off as well, right? So I think that's important to remember, is to pair these literary sources with all of the ritual and cultural practices associated with the telling of those stories. Because most Christians wouldn't have been encountering these stories by, you know, getting a volume down off the shelf and saying, okay, well, let's read about this saint. And, you know, they're not just flipping through these stories one after the next, like we might find them in certain collections today. They're encountering them liturgically. Either they're hearing them, you know, the stories being told by a priest, by a bishop who's preaching about that particular martyr, usually on the day of their death, or they're hearing the story if they visit some shrine, you know, so they're encountering them in ways that aren't just literary. But what I think is particularly interesting, you know, you just to answer this question about how important the martyrs are from even early on, is, as I mentioned before, all of the closest followers of Jesus, with the exception of John, have some story about them, about them dying very violently. About them dying as martyrs. My colleague David Eastman, there's so many deaths of just so many versions of the deaths of Peter and Paul alone, that my colleague David Eastman once published a book that was called The Many Deaths of Peter and Paul, where he sort of goes through all of these different stories, many of which have, you know, more or less the same sort of contours, but many of which are quite different from one another, but all telling different stories about the deaths of these two very important followers of Jesus, right? You know, a lot of these are contradictory in where or how or even when they say that this or that apostle was killed, but we have a lot of consensus traditions, right? That Peter was crucified upside down in certain versions of the story because of his own humility, because he didn't want to directly mimic the death of his Lord, right? And so it's an act of humility for him to be crucified on an inverted cross. That isn't part of the tradition early on, but that, you know, develops as part of the tradition. That Paul was beheaded is the consensus, that both of them were killed, both Peter and Paul, sometime around the early 60s, perhaps in Rome, Nero's Rome, Emperor Nero's Rome. That Bartholomew was flayed, right? He had his, you know, skin peeled off, if flayed isn't a word in your everyday vocabulary.
And we can link to some of the iconography for that, because some of the icons and the images show him holding his skin.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, especially in the altar wall fresco in the Sistine Chapel that painted by Michelangelo, you have this image, thanks to Michelangelo, of Bartholomew, the Apostle Bartholomew, hovering on a cloud right at Jesus's feet. And in one hand, he's got this flensing knife, and in the other, he's holding up the empty bag of his own skin. And the intriguing little side, you know, tidbit of that is that art historians have long surmised that the skin bag Bartholomew's, you know, boneless and sagging face was a self-portrait that Michelangelo quietly painted into the fresco, which is totally fascinating, right? You know, but anyway, I mean, what I think is really interesting about these stories, right? I mean, they go on and on. Simon, you know, maybe was sawn in half. Thomas was speared in India. What I think is interesting about them is that they use the stories of these deaths of the apostles not only as a means of saying something about the apostles themselves and how they were willing to follow Jesus unto death in just as violently a way, but they also justify certain ideals that were important to the Christians who were writing these stories, in many cases centuries after the fact. And a lot of these stories strangely focus on questions of virginity and celibacy, which were very important to a lot of ascetically minded Christians from, say, the fourth and fifth century, you know, and onward. So for just to give one example, in one version of Peter's martyrdom, we're told that Peter somehow had access to Emperor Nero's concubines, and that he was trying to convert them all to lives of chastity, which I think it goes without saying didn't exactly endear him to the emperor, if he's, you know, turning all of his concubines chaste. You know, and there's a similar tradition about Matthew, and where, you know, he's trying to convert the king of Ethiopia. I mean, a lot of these are very fanciful. A lot of them are written, you know, after the fact, but they're often doing, as I said, you know, two things. One, emphasizing the extent to which Jesus's closest followers also embraced deaths along the lines of Jesus's, and two, they can then all tell other, you can use those deaths of the apostles to make moral claims, to tell other stories, to make other points that are important to whoever happens to be writing, you know, the flavor of the day story, about these Christians. But you asked for a long history, and I'm not going to give one since that's most of the book. But I can jump, you know, all the way to the 16th century, and with John Fox's Book of Martyrs. You know, John Fox was this English guy. He was an English Protestant during a time where there's a lot of back and forth, a lot of tumult in English Christianity as it becomes Protestant under Henry VIII, and then swings back to Catholicism under his daughter, Queen Mary, Bloody Mary, as she's known, Mary the First, and then swings back to Protestantism again with the rule of Elizabeth. So these, you know, John Fox has this book that he bills as a church history, the Acts and Monuments, it's called. And it's this massive, ended up as a couple of volumes, and it was published, and it's the second version in which it was published. It's this massive history of the church, but it puts martyrs at the center. In fact, when it was published as two volumes, the whole second volume begins specifically by talking about the martyrs. And what he's wanting to do is chart this genealogy, to draw this narrative line between the martyrs, the Protestant martyrs who were being burned at the stake by Bloody Mary, Catholic queen of England at the time, in the middle of the 16th century, how they are connected to all of these martyrs stretching all the way back to the apostles, right? And just like I was saying earlier, and like you were saying too, like, well, we have these stories, it seems like it was thousands of people being killed. that's the impression when you read John Fox's book too, right? That you think that, oh my gosh, you know, Bloody Mary, she certainly earned her name. She must have killed thousands and thousands of Protestants. Well, actually what happened is that she killed maybe 300 people over the course of about a 3-year period. I mean, that's not an insignificant number, but it's not a genocide, right? And yet it's the stories and the fact that John Fox's book ended up in virtually every English church from the 16th century onward, because Queen Elizabeth saw it as a good propaganda campaign, not only for her reign, but also by way of further Protestantizing her realm, right? And so the stories get told again and again, and it takes on a vastly greater importance than the actual circumstances at the time might have suggested it would.
Yeah, and thanks for using that example in particular, because I think some people watching, listening, they're like, okay, well, you know, when the Protestant Reformation comes along, they kick out the martyrs, right? That's no longer an important aspect of Christianity. So,
yeah,
but very much not true, right? The Protestantism doesn't get rid of the cult of the dead.
Well, hang on. I would say that in terms of the cult part, right? In terms of the feast days on the calendar, in terms of the veneration of relics, in terms of, you know, the pilgrimages and all these sort of other physical, very very obviously Catholic or Orthodox sorts of ritual practices, that those are certainly, you know, not, you know, Martin Luther's not enthralled by those things, right? Yeah. But he does agree that that the story of somebody who testified through their body to their faith by willingly accepting death, that that's important. He agrees that the story can be edifying, right? So the stories persist, and Fox is certainly wanting to tie, as I said, to tie the stories of those who were killed by Queen Mary to this long chain, to create this long sort of chain of Christian suffering, to tie it back to the past. And the Protestants are still very much interested in early Christian history and in the early Christian martyrs, especially the apostles. But it's the cult part that they're not so interested in. Yeah.
Right. So you mentioned relics. Can you explain what relics are and why they have magic powers?
Sure. I mean, so the term, as it's you know, derived from Latin, just means like the remnant of something, or the remains of, you know, what's left behind. So, you know, somebody dies and what's left behind of them? Well, you maybe have their clothes or their shoes or something that they touched, right? So some sort of remnant that's associated with them. But often in Christian contexts, what we mean when we say relics is we're specifically referring to bodily remains, right? Their bones, maybe their fingernails, maybe their hair, but usually their bones, right? The martyrs' bones. And there's a lot of emphasis on the power of these bones in many Christian texts and traditions, for sure, especially beginning in the 4th century with the legalization of Christianity and with the promotion of Christianity, the imperial promotion of Christianity by the Emperor Constantine, who converted to Christianity, and his mother as well, Helena, who goes on this archaeological expedition to the Holy Land and supposedly found the very cross upon which Jesus was crucified, right? Which is interesting in that, obviously, for Jesus, since Christian tradition insists that he was bodily assumed into heaven after his death and resurrection, you don't have the bones, but what you do have are all of these objects that touched him during the time of his death, namely, most importantly, the cross, but also the crown of thorns, the holy nails, the lance that the Roman soldier jabbed into him, and then certainly the relic that everybody's familiar with, the shroud. The Shroud of Turin. Everybody's heard of that, but it's actually quite late. I don't think that there's actually a reference to it until like the 14th century is the first time we have a reference to it. But there are plenty of other divinely infused textiles, so to speak, that were around before the Shroud of Turin that are quite important. I talk about some of those in my book. I won't get into that right now. But back to the 4th century, we have this wonderful letter that Saint Ambrose of Milan wrote to his sister. Ambrose being the tutor and sort of master of Saint Augustine, and the one who sort of led him on and educated him in his embrace of Christianity and Augustine's embrace of Christianity. So Ambrose, Bishop of Milan, he's writing to his sister, and we have the year 386, right? So he's writing to his sister, and he's saying, we've got this new basilica that's just been built in Milan, and everybody is wanting me to properly consecrate it by putting some relics under the altar, bringing in some bones of the saints, bones of the martyrs into the altar. And he says, that I didn't have any, they were out at the corner store that week or something, I guess. And then he says that this divine ardor entered his heart, that he knew where to dig, like some sort of buried treasure, and that he has one of his priests come over and he digs up the bones of Saints Gervasius and Protasius, these ancient Christian martyrs, right? And when the priests dig up the bones, a sick man who had been brought to the site was instantly cured. And then later, as they're processing these bones, from the site of where they had been found, at the site of their burial, into the basilica where they would now be enshrined, a blind man regains his sight, right? So and when Ambrose stands up, after they have properly installed these relics to consecrate this new basilica, when Ambrose stands up and starts preaching to his congregation, he reminds them, he points to the Bible. He reminds them about the passage in the Acts of the Apostles, where we hear that even if Paul touched just a few handkerchiefs or aprons, and that if then those handkerchiefs or aprons were brought to the sick, that they would be instantly cured. And he says, now I'm telling you the same thing. Bring your handkerchiefs, bring your aprons, touch them upon the bones of the martyrs. And then, then you have this this contact relic, you've got this relic that's been, because it's been touched to a relic. That has this sort of divine power, and what Ambrose outlines in many ways becomes kind of a template for the authentication of martyrs' relics. Right, usually they had to cure somebody so that you knew that it was legit. I mentioned Helena before, digging up the supposed cross upon which Jesus was crucified. Well, in the story that's told about it, she digs up three crosses, right? Because of the two thieves who were crucified alongside Jesus. So how do you know which is the right one? Well, she has this sick woman come and she touches the first cross, nothing happens. She touches the second one, nothing happens. She touches the third one, she's cured, right? There's the one, right? That's now been divinely authenticated as the true cross of Christ, right? So you have these bones, you have fragments of the Holy Cross, you've got the crown of thorns, which through a very convoluted set of circumstances supposedly made its way to Paris during the time of Saint Louis, of King Louis the Ninth, and that what he believed to be the crown of thorns was still there in Notre Dame when Notre Dame caught on fire a few years ago, and there was that horrible blaze that brought down its iconic spire and everything else. But that both a tunic that supposedly had belonged to King Louis, as well as the crown of thorns, rescued by the Parisian fire brigade, right? So, a lot of these things haven't entirely disappeared. You can go on eBay and you can still find little fragments of bones that are supposedly authenticated as having belonged to this, that, or the other saint. So there's a long tradition of the importance of the physical remains as conveying the power of the saint. And as many have put it, both in antiquity and scholars today, that the understanding is that the saint is still there, that the saint is in heaven, but is still somehow present on earth in his or her physical remains. And that therefore that the power of heaven, it becomes an earthly conduit to the divine.
An important question I forgot to put in our preparatory sheet, yeah. But intercessory prayer, praying to the dead, with the dead. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Is justified in many ways throughout a number of different centuries and traditions. But there's this idea that the saints namely the martyrs, because I think when we're talking early on, especially, that the martyrs are the saints par excellence through their death and through their suffering, that they have, you know, perhaps you could say it, they have the ear of God, they have the ear of Jesus, that they're proximate to Jesus because of their suffering. And so, you know, you have some ailment, or you know, you are barren and you're hoping for a child or something like that, you pray to the saint for, you know, this this to be given to you, right, or for you to be cured, and those sorts of prayers. I mean, that also helps explain a lot of the pilgrimages to the shrines of the saints, because even though it was understood that, you know, saints could certainly work their miracles from anywhere, that you didn't have to be right next to the bones or something, there was still this idea that they're going to be more powerful at the site where their bones are, right? So you travel, you know, as Chaucer talks about it in a fictional way, the Canterbury Tales is there. It's a storytelling contest among these fictional travelers who are all traveling from London to Canterbury to visit the amazing church in Canterbury, which also had at its eastern end this amazing shrine to St. Thomas Becket, who was killed in his church, and then, you know, immediately becomes this martyr. And to go back to relics, I mean, this is somebody who became a saint overnight, literally. As he was killed in his church, the stones were mopped of the blood, and a townsman supposedly got hold of a piece of cloth that was soaked with the bishop's blood. He brought it home. He rinsed it out as best he could, and he gave the washing water to his wife to drink, and it would immediately cured her of her paralysis, right? You know, these things are just, I mean, that's many centuries after Helena, they continue to be important.
Awesome. Well, I think it's time to wrap up. Of course, we could always talk about more, but you should get the book, everybody. So it is, we've been flashing the address on the screen. We're going to put it in the show notes, but ucpress.edu, and then a whole bunch of other things after that. But Dr. Kyle Smith, thanks so much for coming on the show. Before we go, I'll do our quick commercial for our Patreon, patreon.com/Gnostic. For as little as $1 per piece of media per month, you can help us keep going, and you can fund us buying some relics on eBay. Make sure you check that out, or paypal.me/Gnostic for one-time donations. Dr. Smith, thanks again. Bye.
My pleasure.